Presented in partnership with the U.S. Army Office of Public Affairs, Midwest. The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents. In this special episode, we'll explore the 100-year history of the 1st Army with Lieutenant General Stephen M. Twitty, Command Sergeant Major Richard Johnson, and 1st Lieutenant Kevin D. Braflett. I'm your host, Henry Gundecker, and this program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. It's presented in partnership with the U.S. Army Office of Public Affairs Midwest. This program and hundreds more are available on demand at PritzkerMilitary.org. On April 2, 1917, President Woodrow Wilson received approval from Congress to declare war against Germany and officially bring the United States into World War I. Wilson appointed General John J. Pershing to lead an American expeditionary force in France. Among the units to fight in France was 1st Army. The 1st Army was established on August 10, 1918. In September of 1918, Pershing and the 1st Army drove the Germans out of San Miguel Salient, where the 1st Army captured its first victory. Following the San Miguel victory, 1st Army fought in the Meuse-Argonne Offensive. 1st Army overwhelmed the German forces and helped to penetrate the Hindenburg Line. This was the last of the German defenses on the Western Front. An armistice was called, and the war was over at 11 a.m. on November 11, 1918. 70 soldiers from the 1st Army, including famed Sergeant Alvin York, were awarded the Medal of Honor for Valor in World War I. Still active today, the 1st Army is the oldest and longest-serving field army. The 1st Army provides reserve component training and defense support for civil authorities of the nation. Here to discuss more about the 1st Army are Lieutenant General Stephen M. Twitty, Command Sergeant Major Richard Johnson, and 1st Lieutenant Kevin D. Braflett. Lieutenant General Stephen M. Twitty became the 38th Commander of the 1st Army on July 15, 2016. General Twitty is a distinguished military graduate from South Carolina State University, and he served in the United States Army during Operation Desert Storm and Operation Iraqi Freedom. He served as Deputy Commanding General for the 1st Armored Division at Fort Bliss. General Twitty also served as Deputy Chief of Staff for Strategic Communications and International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan during Operation Enduring Freedom. His decorations include the Distinguished Service Medal, Silver Star Medal, Defense Superior Service Medal, and the Legion of Merit, among many others. General Twitty holds a Master's of Science degree in Public Administration from Central Michigan and a Master's of Science degree in National Security Strategy from the National Defense University. Command Sergeant Major Richard Johnson became Command Sergeant Major of 1st Army on October 21, 2016. Johnson entered the U.S. Army in 1987 and began his training as an armored crewman. In his over 30 years of service, Johnson held numerous positions and duty assignments, including Operations Sergeant Major and Interim Command Sergeant Major of 1st Brigade, 1st Cavalry Division, and Sergeant Major of Combined Arms Center Training. His awards and decorations include Legion of Merit, Bronze Star, and Defense Meritorious Service Medal, among many others. 1st Lieutenant Kevin D. Braflett enlisted in the U.S. Army Reserves in 2009 as a Private First Class. Upon completion of basic combat training, he was assigned to the 91st Training Division Operations as a military intelligence analyst. His responsibilities were to preserve, catalog, and interview veterans from the 91st Division Historic Collection. In 2013, he received his commission as a military intelligence officer. He's currently serving as the aide-de-camp to Major General Chris Gentry, Deputy Commanding General Support 1st Army. In his civilian occupation, Kevin is a co-owner of a military antique museum. Please join me in welcoming to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, Lieutenant General Stephen Twitty, Command Sergeant Major Richard Johnson, and 1st Lieutenant Kevin Braflett. Before we begin our discussion, let's watch this short video about 1st Army.
Created in World War I to fight alongside America's allied partners in Europe, 100 years later, ensuring the readiness of our homeland partners in the Army National Guard and Army Reserve. We are 1st Army.
Over there,
1st Army, America's first numbered army was established in France on August 10, 1918, under the command of General John Blackjack Pershing. Only a few months later, thanks to the valiant fighting efforts of hundreds of thousands of American soldiers and their French and English partners, the war was over. In France, First Army left a legacy of victory in two major operations, the reduction of the Saint-Mihiel salient east of Verdun and the Great Meuse-Argonne offensive west of Verdun. With the Great War at an end, First Army was deactivated in 1919. When the unit was reactivated in 1933 at Fort Jay, New York, First Army had a new mission, which is the same mission we have today, supporting the training and readiness of the Army National Guard and Army Reserve. Until the eve of World War II, First Army commanded six corps of soldiers from the active duty Army, the Army National Guard, and the Army Reserve. In 1943, First Army resumed its field army combat role and moved its headquarters to Bristol, England.
Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition.
On D-Day, June 6, 1944, with General Omar Bradley in command, First Army troops landed on Omaha and Utah beaches in Normandy, France, with First Army commanding all American ground forces during the invasion. Beginning in the 1950s and continuing through the 1970s, First Army mobilized and deployed thousands of soldiers during the Korean and Vietnam Wars. In 1973, First Army transitioned from primarily supporting the active duty Army to improving the training and readiness of the reserve components, as it had between World War I and World War II, and as we do today. In 1990, First Army trained, mobilized, and deployed more than 41,000 Army National Guard and Army Reserve soldiers for Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm. In 2006, First Army's mission expanded to include responsibility for training, support, and mobilization of all Army National Guard and Army Reserve units throughout the entire continental United States. First Army headquarters relocated to Rock Island Arsenal, Illinois. Beginning in 2015, First Army restructured its formations to more effectively support the training and readiness of the reserve component. Today, First Army's 10 training brigades are strategically located throughout the continental United States. Since 2001, First Army has mobilized, trained, and deployed more than 1.2 million soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and civilian interagency personnel for worldwide missions. Today's smaller, leaner, active-duty Army cannot fulfill an increasingly multifaceted global mission without its reserve component partners, and it is First Army's sacred duty to train the Army National Guard and Army Reserve for fights to come. With a century of experience and expertise, First Army remains committed to the training and readiness of our Army National Guard and Army Reserve partners as we look ahead to our next 100 years. First in deed.
Thank you guys for joining me. So I figured we'd start off by talking about it's 100 years of First Army. A lot of people have served in that 100 years, and I understand that two of you have had relatives that have served with First Army. So General Twitty, as well as Lieutenant Bradford, both of you have relatives. Can you tell us a little bit about their service to the organization?
I'll start. First of all, it is an honor to be the Commanding General of First Army. As you mentioned earlier in your opening, we have a long and distinguished history. You know, it started off with General Jack Pershing as the first commander, and General Omar Bradley also served during World War II as the commander. And we also have those that have served on staff, like General Marshall served on the staff as well. And General MacArthur also served on the staff of General Pershing. So we have a long history of distinguished people that have served in First Army. And so it's an honor for me to command this great organization. What I will tell you about my service is pretty personal. Both of my grandfathers served in First Army, and both were obviously a part of a segregated army during that time frame. Both served in the Army Air Corps back in World War II. My mother's father actually served 11 years in the Army Air Corps. And so to come and command this great organization, is full circle for me, because as a young kid, my mother's dad used to march me around, and I used to put on this uniform. And I remember the First Army, the distinguished patch of the First Army on old fatigues that he had in his footlocker. And I used to put those fatigues on and march around his house and salute and so forth. And so, of course, they could not fathom that I would make general, much less command First Army. So it is great to command this organization, and I know that they're smiling down on me for it. So thank you.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah. So tell me about your relatives.
Well, my great-grandfather, Oscar Nyman, was actually drafted into the 91st Infantry Division in World War I, and 91st served under First Army through its campaign in the Moisergon offensive itself. And he was actually wounded the first day of the Moisergon offensive, which ended his war. But I guess fortunately for me, it was just a wound and nothing more. But yeah, that was his story of service and my connection to First Army prior to coming here.
That's pretty, I wish I had stories like that. let's talk about service. As we talked about your family service and personal service. Between the Sergeant Major and General, between both of you, 64 years of service to the Army. That's a lot.
Right.
Almost the time of the 100 years. So tell me about what service means to you and to your families.
Yeah. Sergeant Major, you can go.
Well, Henry, thanks. And again, I'd like to thank Pritzker Presents for allowing us to be here. It's a great opportunity. So service to me, I would say it's in my DNA. Okay, so I don't have relatives that served in First Army that I'm aware of, but with my immediate family, with my father and my brothers, we have over 140 years of service, and over 120 of that has been as non-commissioned officers. So my father's a Korean War veteran, served in the Army National Guard after the war. So have a little connection there, because there was somebody doing the First Army mission that was helping his artillery battery train. So I grew up wanting to be a soldier. Like General Twitty did, I had older brothers that were in the Army. My father, there was still gear around the house. We would go out and play Army. And that's all I really wanted to do, was to be a soldier. And so service for me is very special. For my family, it's very special. My family... It's hard on the families when a family member is a soldier. And we couldn't do it without the support of our families. So I appreciate that. And it means a lot to them. And I really thank them for the support and what it means to allow me to be a soldier.
Yeah. And for me, it's about giving back. This nation has given so much to me. It's given so much to my family. You know, I came from humble beginnings back when my grandfather was marching me around. They lived in a one-bedroom shack. But I always remember that patriotism as he marched me throughout that one-bedroom shack house. But the other piece of it is I went to college on a military scholarship, and, you know, all of my education has been paid for, and you know, I was able to get my education through the military, and so my family has been able to prosper as a result of me going through college and so forth and coming throughout the Army through the military. And so it's not only about commitment to this nation, which I love serving this nation, but it's also the commitment through what the military in this great nation has given me, and that's why I serve.
So August 10th is coming up. It's the centennial of First Army. Lieutenant, can you tell us about First Army back then and what their mission was, and, you know, how did that role change during the war?
Well, it was a unique situation where when the American Expeditionary Forces, which, you know, were commanded by General Pershing, came to Europe, there really was no other organization to manage a large number of American troops are overseas, and we were expecting 1 million to 2 million plus American soldiers to be flooding into Europe at any time. And so it served multiple purposes. It served to give an organization to the Army itself, to the AEF, American Expeditionary Force, and lead an efficient way to fight against the Germans and the German forces itself. But First Army also established a lot of different things and was really the first well, it was the first field army, as we've said before, but it was the first to establish like the staff system. It was first to establish maintaining and managing such a huge army or such a huge number of men and equipment coming over to Europe to fight. And it was really proving the Americans that we were equals to the British and French, you know, our allies. And one of the main things that was important for the creation of First Army was that there was this argument of amalgamation. So the British and French, as the American forces were coming over, the British and French wanted the American forces just to be absorbed into their own ranks because they were hurting so badly for men throughout the entire course of the war that they needed reinforcements, they needed replacements, and they saw the Americans as that answer. And through the president and General Pershing, we stood our ground and said, no, we will not amalgamate. We will have our own separate command. And First Army was that first step to establishing ourselves and putting Pershing as well as the American Army on an equal footing with the Allied commanders. Because before, we didn't have any organization as other than the American Expeditionary Force that would put us on an equal footing with them. And once First Army was formed, now we were an equal. And one of the interesting things was that when First Army was initially formed, Pershing actually was in charge of both the AAF and First Army simultaneously, which was a huge weight for him. But as the war, you know, went on for the Americans, Second Army and the other field armies were formed. First Army basically evolved its role into, you know, being a field army and fighting the campaigns, being San Mihel being the main campaign for First Army to begin the war with. But it was also the first organization to consume or to take in all three components, active National Guard and then Army Reserve or National Army at the time. So that was one of the major roles, was learning how to deal with all these new components or all new means that we didn't have in previous wars.
So this is just a question for anyone. What would you say was probably like some of the most difficult things during that time? Because obviously it was a lot of firsts, a lot of fear, I would say, you know, doing things the wrong way or whatever. Yeah. What would you say about that?
Well, absolutely, in terms of bringing all three components together, particularly the Army National Guard and our active forces during that time frame. If you read the history, most of the National Guard soldiers, they were back here in the U.S. Many of them had not trained in quite some time. And trying to get them formed and sent over to be able to fight such a campaign as World War I, you can imagine that's pretty problematic.
I think I was reading about the general said that he wasn't going to send somebody over there until they had been trained. And
that's
I think
correct.
Some of the French, they trained because they were doing a lot of war in the trenches. And
right.
They trained him before he sent him over there. So there was the general had this, like, this has got to be done before I send my 500,000 troops over there. So, I mean, I thought that was pretty interesting as well.
That's right. And a lot of training was conducted on the ground over in Europe as well. You know, ironically enough, moving forward to what we do today, you know, we train our National Guard and our reservists today across the continental U.S., but, you know, that really started under General Pershing. Back when he was the first Army commander. So he set the footing for what we do today.
And that kind of runs into my next question. How would you say First Army's history ties into the overall history of the Army?
Well, what I will tell you, you heard me talk about the three components, the active, the National Guard, and Army Reserve. Well, we call that the total force, the total Army force. And I got to be honest with you, I think that the three prongs to that Army force, we're pretty close and we're pretty tight today. We've learned a lot of lessons over the past years, particularly a lot of lessons coming out of Desert Storm, where we probably did not work closely together to support that war. And so after coming out of Desert Storm, we took those lessons, and now we implemented what we call total Army force policy, where we bring the units together a lot to train and a lot to conduct mentoring sessions and observer controller exercises and so forth. And so that has really helped us, seeing that we have less than a million man army. We can't do this job of fighting our nation's wars without all three components.
I think the key word is interoperability.
Interoperability, exactly.
I said that one a couple of times. Let's talk about First Army's mission today. Command Sergeant Major.
Well, Henry, thanks. So it's not that much different than it was almost 100 years ago. So we have the unique opportunity to partner with our Army National Guard and Army Reserve soldiers and assist them in their training, building readiness, maintaining readiness. And then we assist in deploying them into a theater in support of a combatant commander. And then once their mission is done, we assist their redeployment and their post-mobilization, get them ready to go back to their communities. In World War I, we had to do, First Army soldiers, leaders had to do similar things, bring people from all over the country, bring them together at some point. Some of them never met each other before. Okay, now we help them, assist them in building teams, which we do very well. They do very well. Before we deploy them into a theater of operations. Going back to your previous question, just ties into this, some of the first, so the trainers that were training soldiers before they went to Europe for World War I were dealing with some capabilities that we'd never seen in the battlefield, chemical weapons, use of chemical weapons, the large employment of machine guns, artillery, accurate artillery, that we hadn't seen in a battlefield before. So we were training soldiers how to deal with that. So our environment today is much similar to that, that we have made such advances in technology and weaponry, tactics and procedures, the environment we're gonna have to fight in, multi-domain environment. It's not just a ground war that we have to be concerned about, that we have to train soldiers to be able to operate in. So our observer controllers trainers today operate in a very complex environment. Very proud of them. They do a great job in assisting our Reserve and Army National Guard soldiers and organization in getting and maintain a level of readiness that we're comfortable that they can deploy and do a mission anytime. So that's kind of what's special for me about tying the two eras together. Even though we're 100 years apart, we're very similar.
What would you say you would hope to aim next 5 years?
So the next 5 years, what I would like to do, get kind of down that route, is one thing, we've got to maintain standards, okay? So our observer coaches and trainers, they have got to be of high character. They've got to be professionals, got to be masters of their craft, because when we, and it's with anybody, if you're training a soldier, they're going to look up to you, okay? You've got to build that confidence. You've got to provide inspiration and motivation to those soldiers that you're training. So I want to maintain that and improve that along the way. So we do that through training, education, and certification. So we certify all our observer controller trainers before we send them out to the field to operate in that capacity. So I want to increase that. One of the challenges is going to be, like I mentioned earlier, about our environment changes so quickly and becomes very lethal, that we, as First Army, as observer controller trainers, stay ahead of the emerging environments. So we are prepared to train soldiers before we put them in harm's way.
Yeah, we spend a lot of time training ourselves in order to train others. You can imagine the environment changes daily. And oh, by the way, we're still a nation, an army that's at war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So while we're training for that fight, we're also looking at emerging threats that may be out there, because we got to adapt to that, and we got to assure that the soldiers are trained to be able to meet those particular threats. And so we spend a lot of time training ourselves, but we spend a lot of time also training those National Guard and Army Reserve soldiers to be able to fight the current war and the future war.
So again, 100 years coming up, August 10th, there is going to be a celebration. General, what do you hope to achieve through that celebration of the centennial?
Well, what I really hope to achieve, we spend a lot of time as well going away from families, doing the business of our military. And during our birthday, what I like to do is come together with all the veterans and just enjoy and reflect our time as First Army. We rarely stop and spend time and reflect, because we spend a lot of time training, as we talked about. We had a ceremony, a ball, last year where we kicked off our one-year celebration, and it was a great event in Rock Island. We brought veterans in from First Army, both past and present veterans, And I got to tell you, it touched my heart to bring the veterans in and really hear their stories. And most of the soldiers that you see serving in First Army, they rarely get to hear the stories about our old veterans. And I want to bring them in during our birthday and, you know, let them tell their stories and reflect on it.
I want to go back to World War I. Could you elaborate just a little bit more on the role, First Army's role in World War I and then in World War II?
Yeah, the role in World War I, it was, like I was saying, it was a multifaceted role. And it was, like General Twitty was saying, was that we had to take a small standing army and incorporate it into, you know, a 1 million plus man army in basically a very short period of time. And so First Army's role, once it was established, was to incorporate those soldiers that were coming from the United States. And then it established training camps within Europe that had British and French trainers to try to give them, they got their basic training, per se, in the United States, and then give them the more advanced training of what to expect in a trench line, the more realistic training from soldiers who had been there. And First Army was the key role in incorporating that, not only for itself, but for follow-on troops that went into the other field armies that were established. And it really set the groundwork for how we would fight the rest of the war. So like 47 days from the San Miguel offensive all the way through to the end of the war, it was First Army's lead that showed the rest of the army how we were going to fight this war. And we did fight it differently than our allies, much to their chagrin that we were the Americans coming over, kind of the American cowboys, but we were the ones that, our First Army was the ones that really set the standard for how we were going to fight the war. So after the end of World War I, First Army actually really became the same thing that we are today as well. We established training camps in Europe for any, you know, new American troops coming in, because we weren't really sure that the armistice was going to last. We weren't sure that the war was going to end after the November 11th armistice had occurred. So we were preparing for the next what if, you know, are things going to start back up? So that was First Army's final role in World War I. Then we were demobilized and reactivated as, again, a training organization, much to the same that we are today. It was when World War II started that we again regained our initial role in, that we did in World War I, where we were, again were a field army. And again, another list of amazing firsts, you know, the first on the beaches in Normandy under General Omar Bradley. And it was an organization that again led the way through the advance through Europe. Like first to meet the Russians at the you know, at the end of the war, close to the end of the war. So it was an amazing history for a field army or army organization.
So obviously, First Army has a lot of history in World War I and World War II. What about the post-World War II operations? What have First Army been a part of?
Yeah, what I'll tell you is that continued history of training soldiers and preparing them for combat. For the Korean War and the Vietnam War, the primary trainers came from First Army. Similar to what occurred during World War I and World War II, where we established camps, where those camps were here in the United States, and we not only trained reserve component soldiers for those two wars, we also trained active duty soldiers to participate in war. And then I also want to talk about the Hurricane Katrina in 2005. The lead person for that effort was a guy by the name of Russ Honore, Lieutenant General. First Army was the coordinating headquarters and staff to lead that hurricane effort down in Louisiana. And then what we do today continues as part of training to ready and mobilize National Guard Reserve soldiers continues today. A lot of people don't know this, but about 20,000 United States Army National Guardsmen and Army Reserve deploy each year going into harm's way. Well, we lead that effort to ensure that they're trained before they deploy. We train about 100,000 National Guard and Army Reservists annually through nine stations that we have brigades out there independently training and partnered with our National Guard and Army Reserve soldiers to ensure that they're trained and ready. You know, it's difficult when you have 2 days a month, as do the National Guard and Army Reserve, and then they have 2 weeks in the summer to really ready themselves for combat. And so we're that bridge to help them out in that endeavor because they have very little time to train. And so that partnership between us and them is critical because, again, we have what I call subject matter experts that can quickly help them and get them trained up to a level to they're ready to deploy.
Would you like to add?
I concur with the general. Okay. But, yeah, and it's all about building and sustaining readiness. In today's environment, it's more about sustaining readiness because in the future we may not have the opportunity to build up to readiness to deploy somebody. So the challenge today is building and sustaining the readiness, which our reserve partners, it's difficult for them to do with the amount of training days that they're allocated for a year. And the answer is not just give more training days because they have civilian employee communities that they're really tied into. They're truly citizen soldiers, and they do a remarkable job. So First Army has the capability based on our subject matter experts, the experience in our formations, that we can get them to a level and help maintain them to a level. So if there is a mobilization, we feel comfortable as leaders, okay, putting these soldiers into harm's way. So it's sobering for me how important and critical the mission of 1st U.S. Army is.
And what I'll tell you also, when you take a look at the National Guard and the Army Reserve, they come with certain skill sets that you're unlikely to find most times in a military unit, active duty unit. You know, you have a lot of reservists that work in the cyber community. You have a lot of firefighters out there, carpenters out there, policemen. And so they bring these skill sets into the active force when they come on active duty. And they really complement us. And so I love working with the Army National Guard and Army Reserve because they just have these unique skill sets that we can tap into while on active duty to really complement the force.
Yeah, through this process, I've learned a lot about First Army that I'm almost embarrassed that I didn't know before. But I've never been under First Army. So I guess my question is, how aware are First Army troops from private all the way to general of First Army's history?
Yeah. So first of all, we have very little privates.
Fair enough.
we are a senior force, a mature force. We have to. So you'll find staff sergeants and above in our formation. And we have several generals and command sergeants, majors in our formation, simply because we have to be the ones to train the force, and you'll find the experience mostly in the senior ranks. And what I will tell you is probably very little do most of us know the history of First Army. And in fact, I'll tell you, I knew very little about First Army before I took command of the organization. All I knew that it had a big A patch on it and that my grandfather served in First Army. And I never thought I'd be selected to be the commanding general of First Army. But I tell you, it's been a unique experience, not only commanding it, but also knowing the history. That's why I have Kevin here, because he's a history buff, and he keeps me straight on the history daily. And so,
I'll insert a caveat on that. General Twitty has been doing an amazing job of pushing and encouraging the First Army soldiers to know and understand our history and to basically share this throughout the force, not only to build the esprit de corps that, hey, you know, we are First Army, and that, you know, basically almost everybody that you've ever heard of, you know, Bradley, Pershing, Hodges, you know, Marshall, MacArthur, they all had their start in First Army at one point or another. General Twitty. Yes, sir. Yeah. And so and it's that same understanding that, you know, we may know of like certain divisions and different things like that, but it's very rare for people to know that they're all connected. They're all connected by that one First Army, you know, and that's one of the things that he's been very encouraging to have the soldiers from the bottom up, you know and share that and appreciate that history. And it builds esprit de corps within the command and the ranks.
And the most interesting thing, First Army has about 8,000 soldiers, that's it. And if you take a look at the United States Army Reserve and the National Guard, we're talking about less than a half a million in ranks. So you take an organization that has about 8,000 soldiers that's responsible with partnering with our reserve component soldiers, plus assisting them with training, we stay pretty busy. And so what I'll tell you is I'm extremely proud of the work we do and the partnership that we have with our reserve component. And we're extremely busy every day, 7 days a week, doing this business.
So, Kevin, you actually mentioned a couple of the heroes of First Army, which, again, I was astonished at how many people are connected to First Army and the legends of it. So just a general question to anybody that has maybe some personal, some of the legends of First Army, maybe some of you guys admire yourself.
Yeah, some of the names that we've mentioned before, I mean, you know, that's many of the commanders that we knew from World War II, you know, that cut their teeth in World War I, General Patton was Colonel Patton in World War I. He was actually wounded during his service with First Army during the Moisés-Argonne Offensive. Colonel Marshall at the time, he was essential that First Army was trying to pull off one of the more complicated moves that had been taking place during the war, was to fully engage itself in the San Miguel Offensive, and then, per our allies' request, disengage, reform, refit, and then move north by a number of miles and re-engage right into the Moisés-Argonne Offensive. And at the time, he was the G3, or the plans and operations, and he orchestrated that. There were some issues with moving over a million men, you know, and equipment in that way, but he was essential in moving those pieces and getting the success of First Army in both the San Miguel as well as the Moisés-Argonne Offensive. And all this experience that they had gained in World War I was surely used, you know, to the optimum in World War II. And so, you know, having that experience under First Army really led to the successes that we had in World War II that we had to unfortunately fight. But it was really those times that those times in World War I that led to the experience that was important in World War II. And not to mention the commanders that we had in World War II, like General Bradley and General Hodges, you know, that we always hear these names, but we never associate them with First Army, and that's really what we're here to do, is that these were, you know, essential commanders for us and, really led the way like First Army did.
Yeah, and you can't forget about General Douglas MacArthur, who led the Korean War. He was on staff as well back in World War I. I think he was a captain or a major. Kevin, I can't remember, but he also served in First Army as well, and he went on and led the Korean War. So,
I know we talked earlier about someone you're pretty fond of.
Yes. So I'll tag on. I've always been a General Bradley fan, okay, since before I joined the Army. So my father was kind of a military historian himself. Had a large library, about 4,000 volumes, most of it military related. I ended up getting some of those. Always read about military history, so big fan. But most people are familiar with the Sergeant Alvin Yorks or the Audie Murphy that are associated, that were in organizations that were assigned to First Army. So there's one individual that I'm very proud of, Private Jack Baker, okay, that served with First Army, actually in First Army headquarters. From a small town in eastern Kentucky, was drafted into the Army, went to report to his first station, and by a timing error was supposed to get on a train to go to basic training. They didn't put him on that train. They put him on a train and sent him to New York City and put him to work. So he never went to basic training. He served for a while in New York City as a mail clerk and then was eventually shipped over to Europe to work for organization that was building up and training, getting ready to invade Europe or France. So he landed on Omaha Beach with First Army, was actually assigned to headquarters First Army, wore the First Army patch all the way until the end of the war. So he was individually parts of all those firsts. So what's very special about this story is Jack Baker is still alive. He's 98 years old, resides in a small town in eastern Kentucky, in General Twitty and myself are going to go visit him later this month and thank him. I'm looking forward to looking in my eye and thanking and shaking his hand and thanking him for his service. So those stories like that are all around. There's those kind of stories. But I thought that was very special that, you know, he's not going to make, no one's going to write a book about him probably, okay? But we need to seek out those kind of stories and get them, move them up so people understand that people did great things and sacrificed a lot for our country in times of war. So I'm very proud of Jack Baker, and I'm looking forward to meeting him.
This is live. You're not going to ruin the surprise or anything, right?
No.
He knows you're coming.
I hope so.
See you in a little bit, Jack.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the centennial, the one that's coming up August 10th. How are you guys planning on celebrating that?
Well, I think we are working on a ball, but we're working on several things. We're first going to get started with some community events. We got a couple of local runs that we're going to participate in. I don't know if you've ever been to Rock Island Arsenal, but my intent is to change that place with First Army patches all over the place. So when you drive in, you see nothing but First Army. So we're working on banners now to put up. And then we're going to do the outreach that Command Sergeant Major talked about. It's not going to just be Private First Class Baker. We're locating other former soldiers that served a part of First Army. And I'm going to take the time out to personally go visit those folks. And then we're going to do a couple of interviews to get it out nationally that it is our centennial. And so we're planning several things, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the year because I want to do something at least monthly to continue to beat the drum about First Army and its significance.
Well, and sir, to add on to that too, is that one of the things that, you know, General Woody's encouraged as well is expanding the knowledge of within the Army, the larger Army itself, about what First Army is and what it's done. Because, you know, before coming to First Army, we knew very little about it. And I think that that's pretty much the consensus across most of the Army, unless you've been touched by First Army in training, you know, with the National Guard or Army Reserve, you know, that, you know, it's kind of this organization that doesn't get a whole lot of credit in general. You know, especially for the amount of the legacy that it leaves behind, you know, and what it does, you know, in training the National Guard and Army Reserve soldiers going over. But it's, you know, expanding that knowledge amongst the Army and then amongst, you know, general population as well, saying this is who we are and where we're going.
100 years is something definitely to celebrate.
That's right. We also want to take some soldiers and take them over to Europe. The centennial that will occur over in Europe, we want to play a part in that. And so we're working now to arrange that and also take some soldiers over.
Sounds. Are you taking volunteers?
You like to go?
Anybody but you.
So listen, I know, Sergeant Major, you talked a little bit about the future. I asked you a question. It was kind of similar to that. But I want to know, in general, just the future of First Army.
We will always have First Army. We'll always have a requirement across the total force for the capability that First Army delivers to the force. Because it's not only to the force we don't talk about. We train capabilities that reside in the Army Reserve and Army National Guard that also enables the joint force, okay, that only exists in those organizations. So the capability we bring to the fight as First Army will always be a requirement, okay? So that's not going to go away. We could have as technology could go leaps and bounds, which it will, but nothing's going to replace a soldier, and nothing's going to replace the fact that a soldier has to be trained before you employ that soldier. So will there always be a capability required like First Army does, and it will reside in First Army. It's difficult for our OCTs. It's not easy. So everything we do is an away game. So they're not training in their backyard. We go to where the requirement is, where soldiers are training with our partners. So a lot of time it's on unfamiliar terrain. It's with unfamiliar organizations sometimes so our OCTs have to be very well adapted. They have to be professionals. And as we talked about before, they're constantly training. We're constantly improving ourselves. So I'm excited about where we're going in the future with our soldiers in First Army, with their mission as observer coaches and trainers. So I guarantee this, we're not going away.
Well, what I will tell you with respect of the future You know, our nation expects our Army to be ready when we go to fight. And part of that readiness includes First Army. If we do not assist our National Guard and Reserve partners in readying the force, then we're sending soldiers in harm's way. And so we spend a lot of time ensuring that we're ready in that force to, when they go into harm's way, that they're able to fight and win. And so I'll tell you that First Army, in playing that critical role, we take it seriously. As I stated earlier, we have just a small amount of time for our National Guard and Army Reservists to get ready, with 2 days a month and 2 weeks out of a year. And so we got to ensure that we play that bridge to ensure that they're ready before moving them out and going into harm's way.
Sounds like you guys figured it out. So we are a museum and library.
I'm not so sure we got it figured out.
So we are a museum and library. And I have to ask, do you guys have any books that you suggest for future soldiers, anybody wants to learn about the Army or what it means to serve?
Well, I have a couple. In fact, I'll tell you, 47 Days, if you want to know more about First Army, please read that. You also have the biography of Alvin York. I started reading that last week, so I encourage others to read that one. But there's one that I'm reading now called This Kind of War. I read it as a captain, and I'm rereading it. And it's based on the geopolitical environment right now. And it's about the Korean War. And you heard me talk about having soldiers ready. Well, we didn't have soldiers ready for the Korean War, and we suffered from it. And we must not make that mistake again. So I encourage all military leaders to read This Kind of War by T.R. Fahrenberg.
So I'm going to offer two. Soldier's Life, biography of Omar Bradley. Next one is Patton, A Study in Command. Okay, what I really like that about that book is it describes the rigorous training that Patton put his troops through, both stateside before they deployed to Africa and even after they were deployed, all the time that he was fighting, the discipline he instilled in his forces and the rigorous training that allowed Patton's forces that he commanded throughout his career to excel and get after the mission. So if you want to talk, if you want something that would be an eye-opener that talks about training and how to train soldiers, I recommend that book.
Well, I have to kind of go along with General Twitty on 47 Days. It's the one of the essential works that describes the genesis of First Army and you know, the troubles that we went through as a nation and as you know, in a growing army and a growing force within Europe, and how we were able to do that in such a short period of time. And as the book's title says, 47 days, you know, it's just from the start of the San Miguel offensive to the end of the Moisergon offensive, that was our major combat period. But we had grown so much as an army, and for much of that led by First Army. You know, the learning of going from, you know, a 19th century army to a modern army that we're still, you know, using a lot of the lessons today. And then since my role with First Army, I have to say Genesis of First Army is one of the books that the Army published about First Army's history, and is really one of the essential works, talks about the nuts and bolts of how First Army was formed and fought the war itself. So those would be my recommendations.
Sound like good recommendations. So I think it's time that we're going to go to the audience for some questions.
My question is for the general and the sergeant major. Now, you each have significant responsibilities. What do you worry about?
Well, that's a pretty easy question for me. As you heard me talk about the 100,000 soldiers that we train annually and the approximately 20,000 that we send into harm's way, well, at the end of the day, it's my responsibility and my sole responsibility to ensure that they're all trained and ready to fight. And so I do worry about whether or not we've gotten it right in terms of the training that we provide to our soldiers.
So if I had spoken first, I would say exactly the same thing the general did. Seriously. So it's about, nobody wants to send a soldier into harm's way unless they're trained absolutely to the best we can, they're equipped, the best we can, and they know how to employ that equipment the best we possibly can.
But with all the social issues that are going on, all the changes in technology, there's got to be specific things that you worry about, I would think.
Well, what I will tell you is I don't spend much time on the social issues that are going on. I spend every single day. I travel across this nation every single day. About 3 to 4 days a month is actually spent in my headquarters because I'm forward ensuring that soldiers are being trained to the best that we can possibly train them. So I don't spend a lot of time on those social issues. I spend more time trying to understand the environment that our soldiers will go in.
So I would offer you this, that if you go spend time with a soldier nowadays, anywhere, you'll discover we're in a good place with our soldiers. Okay, I'm not concerned about our soldiers' ability to do their mission. Okay, absolutely not. I'm very confident as long as we can provide them the training equipment they need, we'll be okay.
General, being that we're in Illinois, Rock Island's in Illinois, are the public going to be able to come to any of your celebrations?
Absolutely. We want to, it's also critical, and we did not talk about this up here. It is critical that we connect to the American people. And we have worked on that last couple of years because when I was growing up as a young officer, I don't think we did that well, connect to the American people. And at the end of the day, it's your army. And the army is made up of the fabric of our society. And we have a tendency to get behind our rock walls at Rock Island Arsenal and other installations and forget about what the army is all about, and is about people. And those people come from you all. And so when we did our ball this past summer, we invited all the locals to come out, and we had more locals there than we had military. And so you all want to be a part of our celebrations. We just forget to invite you all to be a part of them. So you all are all invited.
I have an online question. This is from Mark, and this is directed towards Command Sergeant Major. You're a 37th Armored Regiment veteran. Courage conquers. The question is, when did you serve in the 37th, and which battalion were you with?
No Slack Battalion. So I actually served, it was my first duty assignment with 3rd Battalion, 37th Armored Regiment with the 1st Infantry Division at Fort Riley, Kansas. I deployed with them to Desert Shield and Desert Storm. So I served with them from 1988 until 1991. And so I'm very proud to be regimentally affiliated with the 37th Armored Regiment. As a tanker myself, which is known for being commanded by General then Lieutenant Colonel Creighton Abrams, who the Abrams tank is named after. So very proud to be associated with that regiment.
This question is to General Twitty and Command Sergeant Major. Given the constraints of the training days that you have, what are some of the top challenges you face with regard to readiness?
That's a great question. By the way, Jeff, thanks for your service. For those of you that do not know this, Jeff served under my leadership in Afghanistan, so it's great to see you. I'll tell you right off the bat, it's the fundamentals. It is absolutely the fundamentals for us. Things such as field craft. By serving in Iraq and Afghanistan in our remote bases and so forth, and trying to make that transition to where we're fighting a superior threat. You heard our Chief of Staff of the Army talk about near-peer threats, those high-end wars and so forth. So making that transition to where you're fighting insurgents to now you're fighting what the Army was truly designed to, was fight the major wars. That's been a huge transition. And within that transition, it is the basics of field craft that is really hard to inculcate into our soldiers these days. The noise and light discipline, the no smoking when you're in close proximity to the enemy, to keeping on your uniforms, those basic blocking and tackling things It's been a huge transition for the force. We're getting there. And I will also remind you that we have the best army in the world, but the honing in on those particular skill sets, we still have a ways to go. So thanks for that.
I again concur with the general. So it's those basic soldier skills, okay, that are perishable, okay, that you become proficient with repetition. So that is a challenge with a soldier that only has 37 days a year to train.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just the basics of digging a foxhole to live, work as in fight out of, you know, all those type things we haven't done in quite some time that we're trying to rebuild in the force.
First of all, gentlemen, thank you for your service. But historically, we've always lost the first battle of the next war, of the wars we have fought. But I just want to ask, are we ready for the next one?
Well, what I'll tell you, that's a good question. That's a loaded question. I will tell you that the number one priority is for us to be ready. But more importantly, it's more than just about being ready. It's about winning. And it's about our soldiers having a mindset that winning is the only way to go and there's no other option. And so what we're trying to do now is not just make our soldiers ready. And I always use the analogy, and I'm a huge football player. I love to watch college football. So if you watch the national playoffs this year between Alabama and Georgia, both teams were extremely ready, right? That game could have gone any way. Georgia could have won the national championship. But the difference maker was you had a coach on the sideline by the name of Nick Saban, and you had a freshman quarterback. And the one thing that they displayed that really won the game, in my view, grit and guts. So two things, grit and guts. That was a gutsy call to set up a freshman to throw that ball in the corner of the end zone on the last play that could have lost the game. And that's what we want our soldiers to have, grit and guts. So we're ready, but it's more than just being ready. It is winning. And the way you win is to have grit and guts.
Is it far more difficult to teach trained soldiers in urban warfare than it is field craft that you do, say, in the mountains of a place like Korea or the flatlands of Europe?
Yeah, what I will tell you is our soldiers have to be prepared to fight anywhere. And it is no secret that most people live in close proximity to water. And there's no secret that most of those places in close proximity to water are urban buildings and facilities. And so I'm a product of a young battalion commander that fought the Thunder Run in the Battle of Baghdad. I was in the 3rd Infantry Division. I was a Task Force Infantry Battalion Commander and was a part of that assault. And so I thoroughly understand fighting in an urban environment. But prior to getting to that urban environment, I had to fight in desert environment. I had to fight in the mountain environment. Then I had to fight in that urban environment. And so we have to train our soldiers to be able to fight across the spectrum of what they're going to have to deal with. But I would agree with you, the urban fight is the hardest fight.
Sir, Sergeant Major, Lieutenant Colonel Brian Gerber, I'm downtown here at University of Illinois Chicago, doing ROTC, sir, like you mentioned, First Army alumnus as well. I have about 40% of my commissioning class are going to join the Guard and Reserve, and much like the Army that we went to war with, they're joining units that they know are going to deploy. And they're going to come back, and when their service meets this great city who's extremely grateful but may not know what they've been through. Would either of you have advice that I can take back to them to address that civilian-military gap that's some have called it that?
Yeah, well, I'll start and then I'll turn it over to Command Sergeant Major. it goes back to what I said earlier. We have a responsibility that I'm not so sure that we've taken on appropriately. And our responsibility is to engage the American people. So what I will tell you is that your soldiers, when they come back, they're going to be proud of their service. But all these civilians are going to be proud of you as well. And you need to take that time to connect with the civilians so they fully understand not only what you've been through, but they can celebrate that great service that to the nation that you've been part of. They really want to do that. And I did not understand that coming up, how much that, you know, I used to go back to my hometown. I'm from South Carolina. You probably can tell by my country accent. But my parents, my family, my neighbors, they wanted to celebrate my service. And I'm not so sure that I allowed them that opportunity to do so. And so I would just pass that on to you.
Ooh. Hey, great question. Thank you, sir. So I'm a Cadet Command alumni, so I appreciate what you do and the complex environment in which you do it. I would offer this, that encourage them to tell their Army story and the Army story of their soldiers and of their families. Okay, one thing we kind of leave out sometimes is we talk about our experiences, we talk about the experiences of our soldiers. But I think it's critical that we also include the experiences of our families and our friends, and specifically with the Army Reserve and National Guard, is with the experiences they have with their community employer, okay, how they reintegrate back with that, and if they had any communication while they were deployed or while they were on active duty status with their employer, with their communities outside of their families. And if they didn't, I would encourage them to do that and just continue to tell the Army story.
Thank you. Great job.
Thank you to Lieutenant General Stephen M. Tweedy, Command Sergeant Major Richard Johnson, and First Lieutenant Kevin Brafflett for a great discussion about First Army. And to the U.S. Army Public Affairs Midwest for partnering on this program. To learn more about the topic, visit army.mil. To learn more about the museum and library, visit in person or online at PritzkerMilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Visit the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. Explore original exhibits on military history or be a part of a live studio audience. Watch other episodes of Pritzker Military Presents. Find out what's on at PritzkerMilitary.org. Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.